If we could take our seats. Good morning and welcome to the April 22nd edition of the Joint Committee on Stream Restoration and Species Recovery. Today we're going to move as quickly as possible through some public hearing and possible work sessions. At the end of the agenda for those bills, we're going to go into a public hearing on three bills very quickly and then a work session on 3225. This morning, I believe also it is Take Your Child to Work Day, and I see there are some folks in the audience who have brought their kids to work, and I'd like the parents to stand and introduce their guests, if that's possible, right here in the front. And good morning, Thomas. Good morning, Laura. You got his name is... Hello, Crystal. Anybody else? Well, welcome to our hearing, and it's nice to see you here. It'll give you a chance to find out what your parents really do here in the brick pile in the big Capitol building. But we welcome you to our hearing, and hope you enjoy what you hear today. Let's go ahead and go into a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 1163. I have the sign-up sheet. We have three folks that have signed up, but before we go into that, we'll have a staff summary. Judith, if you will, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, you will find a staff master summary at your seats. Senate Bill 1163 does provide that landowners are not liable under tort claims, either statutory or made by rule, for any personal injury, death, or property damage that arises out of the leaving of trees and other debris on the property by the landowner. I want to point out that this liability limitation applies specifically to wildfire, erosion, flooding, diversion of waters, damage to public improvements, and any other injury or damage resulting from the trees are to be left on the property. It does, however, accept liability for intentional acts, of course, by the landowner and by gross negligence. Gross negligence is actually specifically defined in this measure as negligence that materially is materially greater than the mere absence of reasonable care under the circumstances and that is characterized by indifference to or reckless disregard of the rights of others. I will point out that since this is affecting a legal liability, it doesn't have any fiscal revenue impact, but it does have a subsequent referral to our Judiciary Committee.
Any questions from the panel? If not, I'll call the folks that have signed up for public testimony. We are in public hearing on SB 1163. Terry Lammers, Ray Wilkerson, and David Mormon have signed up to testify, and I'd like to call all three forward, please. Okay, and Greg, Ray will testify after these two, along with Mr. Greg Miller. Gentlemen, begin.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Terry Lammers. I'm the State Issues Coordinator for the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. We represent about 2,500 members throughout the state, and we altogether there's somewhere around 160,000 non-industrial private forest landowners in the state of Oregon. I'll be brief. You've got a long agenda. We think it's a very good bill. Judith did an excellent job of describing the contents of it, as usual. And let me put it in a different manner. You read the bill. You understand it. It might be the equivalent of the reason for this bill would be a person pulls up to a stop sign, a person on a bicycle runs into the side of that person in the car, and then later claims that the person who stopped at the stop sign is liable for the bicycle injuries. The person stop sign as required by the rules of the road and shouldn't be liable. And we believe we're in the same situation as landowners. We're required to leave trees. We feel we shouldn't be liable for what happens with those trees or debris or whatever when we are in compliance with the law. That will be the end of my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the panel? I just point out that the it is in fact the tree or leaf tree or wildlife tree or other that's required to be left that we're referring to here.
Yes.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Messing, members of the committee, my name is David Mormon. I'm the policy unit manager for the Forest Practices Program at the Department of Forestry. We're very supportive of the intent of Senate Bill 1163. We're not taking a position primarily because it's a legal bill rather than a forest resource protection bill, but we did want to make some points that might be useful to the committee. Currently, state law does provide limited liability protection to forest landowners who are conducting projects. They're regulated wildlife enhancement projects that are regulated by the Forest Practices Act or done under a GWEB grant. Just yesterday we were at a hearing where we were discussing House Bill 3393, which would expand that liability protection to also provide liability protection for landowners who don't remove large wood from streams. Clearly the trend is for forest landowners to continue to by law retain trees and debris in certain situations on their land through current processes, looking at our state water protection rules and the protection of public safety from rapidly moving landslides. There's a potential for those retention requirements to increase. Therefore, I think it's very important and timely that we be discussing this issue right now. We encourage the committee to look at the bill closely. I think our impression is that on initial read-through, the bill is fairly broadly worded and might have some unintended consequences. As far as application on the ground, obviously landowners often leave many trees and debris for good purposes on a voluntary basis, and it may be very difficult in a liability situation to determine which trees are being left voluntarily versus which trees are being left by rule. And an example I use in the written testimony, we have the Forest Practices Act, a leave tree requirement for a clear-cut harvest where you are required to leave 2 in-unit trees per acre for wildlife habitat. If a landowner says, gee, that's a great idea, I'm going to leave 3 trees per acre, then someone would have to sort out which third of those trees were not exempt from liability and which ones were. We also believe that some further review is necessary to see how this bill would interact with our current state fire liability laws and whether there'd be any unintended consequences there, and the department would be happy to work with the committee to sort through that.
Well, Mr. Roman, I thought it would be obvious from the intent of the bill that the 2 trees that were still standing that didn't fall down and hurt anybody were the trees that belonged to the landowner, and the one that did fall down and hurt somebody was the state's tree.
That's probably true.
Questions for Mr. Roman? Senator Shields.
I don't have a question for him, but earlier you made reference to the kind of tree. I couldn't hear you.
A leaf tree?
You're saying deciduous?
Oh, no.
I don't understand.
Thank you, Senator Shields. I apologize. We do use jargon all the
time.
Yes,
you do.
A leaf tree.
And I use human services jargon, so give me an acronym or something, would you?
All right. The deciduous tree would be considered a leaf tree.
Yes, one that says leaf, me alone.
Right. A leaf tree would be one left for wildlife habitat, for retention of shade, for bird nesting, and other purposes. And I apologize for the use of the jargon.
I just wanted to make sure I was in the right area. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator Shields. Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Call Mr. Greg Miller and Mr. Ray Wilkinson. And Mr. Wilkinson, I see you're here with your son, Greg Miller, today. On the
Good Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkerson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'll be brief, too. This is a pretty simple, straightforward bill, and I would like to make a simple, straightforward statement in support of it. Just to put it a little bit in perspective, as I think most of the committee members know, private forest landowners operate under a pretty sophisticated regulatory system through the auspices of the legislature's passage of the Forest Practices Act. Our estimates is that somewhere around 7% of the private forest land base is basically off limits to logging because of the forest practice rules. Most of that cost is in leave trees that we cannot harvest because the rules require us to leave them for protection of fish, wildlife, and water quality primarily. We're not complaining about that regulatory burden. We think the rules make sense, that there are public resources that exist on our lands that need to be protected, and we're willing to shoulder that burden. Just a little additional perspective in terms of the cost. These rules are not cheap. Representative Morgan's predecessor introduced a bill every session for a number of sessions to basically give a tax credit just for the trees that are left in riparian areas, stream buffers to protect streams and water quality. Two sessions ago, the Legislative Revenue Office did an estimate of what the cost of that would be if the tax credit was on the books and all landowners took advantage of it. And the answer was $35 million a year. So that's the value of timber that we leave every year in stream buffers to protect fish and wildlife, or fish and water quality and wildlife that we're not compensated for. Again, though, we're not here to complain about that. We think the rules are reasonable and make sense. This bill deals with the liability if those trees fall down in a way that could cause damage. And I guess it's our view that if there's a risk or hazard created because of the application of those rules, it's a risk that's been created by state law and state policy, and the liability ought to be on the state and not on the landowner. So that's what this bill would do, and we think it's a good bill. Mr. Miller can talk about some actual examples of where this has been a problem, so we're not just, it's not just a solution in search of a problem here. Thank you very much.
Questions? Mr. Miller.
For the record, Greg Miller with Weyerhaeuser Company. My role in this is also to bring to you a real-life example. At our urging, through our trade association, Oregon Forest Industries Council, we actually had a situation this winter where a large conifer tree, a Douglas fir, fell from our riparian buffer, which is the streamside buffer, into the Kalapuya River. The Forest Practices Act and stream rules asks us to mandates that we leave those trees there for fish habitat. And this means when this happened, our riparian rules are working. There was a harvest unit in 1992. We left the buffer. The tree fell in the river. The downstream landowner, whose dwelling is located in a floodplain, was saying that the tree was forcing the flow of the Kalapuya River towards his home, and that we were liable for the damages. In fact, he wanted us to remove the tree or significantly modify the fallen tree. We went through the normal process with the Department of Forestry, ODF&W. Waiver was granted. We resolved that situation as a good neighbor policy, but we own 600,000 acres out there in Oregon, and a lot of it has stream courses, and we put these riparian buffers in. And so every time we're confronted with this issue with a downstream landowner, we have that potential liability, and hence we think that the liability ought to rest on the state and not on either party, either the downstream landowner or the upstream landowner. So I just wanted to bring that real-life example to you. We resolved it in a satisfactory way, but it is a situation we confront every day.
Mr. Chair.
Question, Senator
Kearney. Greg, is that why we have language in the bill that relates to diversion of waters?
I beg your pardon?
Is that why we have language in the bill that relates to the diversion of waters?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Further questions? Gentlemen, how do you react to the comment by Mr. Moorman from the Department of Forestry that indicates that the language is overly broad, that there's vagueness in that language? Mr. Chairman, our where this problem exists is primarily in stream buffers. So our real desire here would be to get some protection from liability for trees that fall into streams and that potentially cause a problem downstream. And by the way, there are instances, we're not saying that under no circumstances should a tree be taken out of a stream or a log be taken out of a stream. There are instances where the costs and the potential damage outweigh the benefits for the tree. But it's just a question of whose responsibility it is, whose liability it is. We don't read the bill as being overly broad. If it is, and if there's a legitimate concern, we certainly would, you know, if it was narrowed to just deal with riparian leaf trees, you know, that would solve 90% of what we see as what the problem is. The other comment that was made about, you know, some people leave more than they're required to, if a landowner leaves a tree for wildlife protection, water quality protection, for fish habitat, seems like that ought to be covered also. I mean, any if you've got a 50-foot buffer along a stream and you leave all the trees and they're there for protection of public resources, then it ought to be not the landowner's liability if there's a problem caused by any of those trees, whether they're left voluntarily or required to be left.
I realize that neither of you are attorneys, but isn't it a point of fact that if there is an issue that has potential liabilities, the courts are going to have to settle these things anyway? And doesn't this bill just provide an affirmative defense for a landowner, something that you can raise in court as a potential defense?
Not being an attorney, I can neither confirm nor deny that. I think that's our intent.
Mr. Wilkerson, isn't it amazing that our children are always taller and better looking than we are? Any questions for the panel, Co-Chair Messerly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to get clarification from you folks. I know we've had a case in Coos County, I believe it was on a county parks land, it wasn't on private property, in which a tree fell down and hit a fisherman and killed him. But what I want to clarify is that are we only talking about trees that would fall into the stream or in the riparian zone? You could have injury or problems that didn't necessarily fall into the waterway. Are we covering that as well? You could have personal injury on the stream bank.
I think, Representative Messerly, this bill is broadly written and would cover an array of instances, probably including the one you just mentioned. And again, you know, we'd certainly be amenable to discussing ways that if this is too broad, that it you know, could be made more narrow.
Well, I was thinking just the opposite, make it broad enough to cover all of those instances there.
We could do that also.
Thank you. And this may be a question for Judith. I'm not sure, but I mean, we're talking about this being too broad, which I don't think it is. But I mean, if we are talking about trees and debris left under these provisions in ORS, we basically are talking about riparian areas anyway, because that's what these. I mean, that would be the reason that these are being left. So I think it's all. The universe is already fairly well defined here in the ORS, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, that's correct. And in addition, the bill does state also any rules that would apply to those sections.
I could comment on that, Mr. Chairman. The statutory citations are the Forest Practices Act. But as Mr. Mormon testified, there are other requirements for wildlife protection. We're on a clear cut unit, for instance, we are required to leave 2 standing trees per acre. So if you have a 50-acre clear cut, we're required to leave 100 trees left standing, not necessarily in a riparian area. So there are additional instances where the regulations require us to leave trees other than riparian zones.
Yeah, follow Mr. Chair. I guess, notwithstanding that, we are dealing with things that are being left under compliance with regulation, so it's not. You know, the universe is fairly well defined here. It's what we're talking about, and broad protection in that universe, I think, is appropriate.
Further questions for the panel? Is there any other person here present that wishes to testify to Senate Bill 1163? Seeing none.
Thank you. Oh, was there a hand up in the back? Come on up. Mr. Stone, how are you, sir?
Well, thank you. Good morning, Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee. I'm Charlie Stone, Assistant State Forester for the Department of Forestry. And since the discussion was centering on the too broad or not too broad in the bill, just want to clarify the concern the department has about being too broad. In particular, and we don't know for sure if this is a problem or not, but we'd like to explore it a little bit. The use of the language in here about wildfire or other laws or rules that require debris left, and then the use of the word damage. We're concerned particularly about unintended effect, or at least it appears that it was not the intent, that it might compromise our cost collection laws and requirements under the Fire Protection Chapter 477. I guess if there was some language in there, and we haven't tried to develop this yet, but it says notwithstanding Section 1 of this bill, nothing here was intended to change the effects or the effect of Chapter 477 and cost collection for fire liability, then that would take away a lot of our concern. So I don't think it was the intent here to change cost collection, as Ray Wilkerson stated, that this is primarily involving the riparian areas and that type of thing.
Ali?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Turner.
Is it possible that the chair of the committee could enter that dialogue into the record and make it part of the intent?
It is possible, Senator Turner, to do that, but I think what I'm hearing is the department feels much more comfortable if that was in the statute. The question I have for the committee is, do we want to go ahead and take action in this morning session on a work session and with the caveat that we'll work with the department on an amendment, a friendly amendment that would be put forward in the House consideration of the bill? We have a moving target. We have closing windows. It's time to move legislation or let legislation go away. And my concern is that if we had this amendment on the table in the form of a dash amendment that had been through legislative council, we'd just move it into the bill and move it out this morning. But I'm concerned that if we delay this process, that we won't have time to move it through the other chambers.
If it's helpful, we'd be happy to try and work something up to get it in at the House if the committee's right with that along those lines to not slow down the process.
I'd be happy to help with that process. I'm sure other members of the committee would also, House members. But we are both chambers, aren't we? So this is the year. Any suggestions, Judith, to move this bill forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that as long as the members were comfortable with the conceptual amendment, and which would be, my question would be, would it have been a fiscal, any kind of fiscal or revenue impact?
No, I don't believe
what you're suggesting. Well, in that case, if it's the members' pleasure, we certainly could do a conceptual amendment that I could drop with the bill, so it is with the bill when it goes to both floors.
The conceptual amendment would be for an exemption under the Fire Protection Act or Fire Protection Clauses.
Yeah, just to make sure that this bill didn't provide a
affirmative defense
against the cost collection for fire liability.
Is there any question from the proponents of the bill that would be a problem? No, I hear you.
Point of clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I did want to point out that also, since we are acting as both chambers, this bill will come back to this committee as it passes through to the other chamber. We can also have an actual amendment ready for the members and amend it into the bill when it comes back through, whichever is your choice.
Actually, members, I'm much more comfortable with seeing an amendment put in as it comes back through, since we'll all be able to see the language at that point. But if the members wish a conceptual amendment, we could do that also. Either way, let's do this with the amendment to be drafted and dropped with the as the bill passes from the Senate chamber to the House chamber. I'll be in work session now and consider
a motion on Senate Bill 1163. We're in work session on 1163. Representative Cruz?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move Senate Bill 1163 to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Any questions on the motion? Anyone have an objection to the motion? If not, so ordered. I will carry. We'll be moving into a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 1287. Staff will present a summary of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, you will find at your seat both the staff measure summary and a hand-engraved version of the Dash 1 amendment. Senate Bill 1287 requires the State Parks and Recreation Commission to use money in the Parks and Natural Resources Fund, that is the Measure 66 fund that we'll be creating, to purchase at fair market value the property known as Thompson Mills and associated property and water rights, and further to develop that property as a historic site. It further requires the department to contract with an independent firm to appraise the water rights for that purchase contract. It states on the face of it that there's a legislative finding that the purchase of the site meets the public purpose in the measure for use of the Measure 66 funds. It directs the department to maintain adequate water flow at the site for the purpose of fish passage. The original bill says during critical passage times, and I'll talk about how the amendment changes that in a moment. The Senate Bill 1287 prohibits the department from enforcing water rights unless the water level falls below a certain point, 15 cubic feet per second at Shearer Dam. It establishes the Thompson Mills Interpretive Center Fund, appropriates money, puts a expenditure limitation on the State Parks and Recreation Department, and it does declare an emergency effective July 1st, 1999. With the Dash 1 amendments in the measure, if you will look on page 2 of the hand-engraved version of the bill, section 4, you'll see it does delete some specifics with respect to the use of the 1933 and 1958 water rights as well as the 1985 hydroelectric water right, and instead inserts that the commission shall retain permanently the ownership of the related water rights and to maintain the water rights at the site. In addition, it does say that it's with respect to water flow that a water master, it does prohibit the department from requesting a water master to regulate distribution of the waters of the river until the river falls to 15 cubic feet per second or less. So if it's less than that amount, that's what the amendment adds into that concept. And it does direct the department to maintain that water flow. Here we're changing identified critical passage times to important passage times to a looser, that would be a looser definition of when those passage times might be determined. And also the amendment does state that the money can be used not only to acquire and develop the property, but also maintenance costs at the site. And then finally, direct monies deposited in the Parks and Natural Resources Fund, again, that's the maintaining concept to maintain the site. Let's see, we have a subsequent referral on this measure to the Ways and Means Committee. We do have in our possession a no-impact revenue statement and our purple potential fiscal impact statement because of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. And in keeping with our traditions in the hearings, we'll offer the first opportunity to speak to Representative Krupp, who will also be leaving in a few minutes to attend hearings of his own. We also have Representative Atkinson in the audience, and he will speak after Mr. Babbitt made his presentation. So, Mr. Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and esteemed members of the committee. It's my pleasure to come before you today. With me today is Mr. David Babbitt, who's the owner of the Thompson Mills property. And the reason I'm here is because I'm a co-sponsor of this legislation. This marvelous piece of property is located just north of my farm in the district that I have the honor of representing, District 37 in Linn County. It's just slightly south of Albany. Today you have what I think is a marvelous opportunity to create a win-win situation, which is not only my estimation of what we have before us here today, but many others, including U.S. Senator Gordon Smith. You'll see there's a letter from him supporting this effort. You have the opportunity today to do two wonderful things, and that is preserve someone's private property rights and also preserve a fish. The Thompson Mill property, which has been operating continuously, is one of the oldest operating continuous businesses in the state of Oregon since just before Oregon became a state. It comprises, it is the area that comprises the Calapooya River drainage basin, which runs through the valley floor. It is a very historic site, not only from its operating as a flouring mill and grinding mill for all of these years, but also because this entire area is home to the Calapooya Indians and is basically their camping and hunting grounds. It has a great many tributaries, streams that flow into it. It is home to the only native steelhead run that's left in the Willamette Valley, is the Calapooya Basin. It is an area that holds significant, by the way, there's also spring Chinook runs that come up through the system. It also holds great significance for me and my family because one of those tributaries drains through part of my family's farmland. It is an area that in a couple of these tributaries, I will admit to having skipped school during my years at the Central Linn school system and on those wonderful warm May and June days and gone out and went swimming in some of these areas. We have an opportunity, like I stated previously, to really create a marvelous opportunity for a win-win situation in terms of fish protection. The acquisition of this property by the state of Oregon will ensure that it will also ensure that Mr. Babbitt's family's property is not diminished in its value by the coming juggernaut of National Marine Fisheries Service regulations coupled with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's possible changes they may require of Mr. Babbitt and his family and his property in the coming years in regards to fish. I think it's important, and this is why I'm so passionate about this issue, it's important that our constitutional protections that exist in the U.S. Constitution against takings are protected here. And with Measure 66 money, clearly I think we have the opportunity to preserve the value of this property by the state's acquisition of it, and also then allowing the state to then, as the owner of that property, to do whatever measures they feel is necessary to continue the steelhead and chinook runs on this piece of property. It also allows, and one of the individuals is in the audience today who is an irrigator, as I am, out of this system. I do not irrigate out of this system directly. This gentleman does. It's important to his dairy and cattle feeding operation, and those protections are also in this bill. I would urge your very strong and serious consideration to this proposal, and Mr. Babbitt will detail it in great significance, and you have before you a packet that really demonstrates to you, I think, the entire concept and its value, not only the state of Oregon as a possible historic site, as a possible site for continued sport fishing, preservation of our Chinook and steelhead, But most importantly, in my mind, is the preservation of this property and its value to the Babbitt family. And with that, I will take my leave if there are no questions, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Questions, Mr. Listen, why don't you have no questions for Mr. Anstruck?
I don't want to get him going.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Babbitt, Mr. David Moon, and Harry Seeley. Composure.
I know. I've learned.
Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, my name is Dave Babbitt. I own and operate Thompson's Mills. I have with me today David Moon on my left and Harry Seeley on my right, and I would like to let them speak first to the issues.
Thank you, David. Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Moon, and I'm here representing the owners of Thompson's Mill. Senate Bill 1287, which would result in the purchase of Thompson's Mill and its related water rights, as you just heard, is an incredible opportunity for the state to purchase a unique historic resource as well as important water rights for the fishery resource, and that's why it could very well result in a win-win situation. One of the things I wanted to do is explain briefly this 15 cubic feet per second limitation, because there have been a lot of questions about that. This 15 cubic feet per second call limit, we'll refer to it as, resulted from a very long, difficult negotiation a couple of years ago that was done with local irrigators, with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Parks and Recreation Department, and the owners. For over a year, I acted as a go-between, I guess you'd say, working on behalf of the Babbitts to discuss with these parties what their concerns would be and how they could satisfy the needs that the different parties had as far as flow levels were concerned, the fishery needs as well as the parks and recreation needs, assuming their purchase was made, and also protection for local irrigators so that there wouldn't be significant impacts to their irrigation. And we realized that a water management plan of sorts would be necessary so that the parties could support the proposal and just frankly as a political measure so that legislation could come before this body and be successful. Now, of course, the context is kind of the divisive nature of water rights controversies. We're all too familiar with that. But because of the way we collaborated and came to an agreement, we felt like that was, you know, a very important process. And it required everybody to compromise, obviously, in what their ideal positions would be. And it certainly wasn't easy getting the local irrigators, ODF&W, and Parks and Rec all on the same page. But as a result, an agreement was reached. Now, that agreement has basically been memorialized in a letter of intent that was written by the director of Parks and Recreation, Robert Minen, and is attached, I believe, to the back of Dave Babbitt's testimony in a letter dated May 9, 1995 to Peter Jensen. As I said, this more or less set out this call limit of 15 CFFs, which is then contained in the legislation. And basically, by that, the Parks and Recreation Department agreed not to request the distribution of the waters of the Kalapuya, regulation of Kalapuya flow levels, to satisfy the water rights unless the flow level of the Kalapuya dropped to 15 CFS or lower. So what that does in one sense, that's important, of course, is it does provide, and this measure would provide, 15 cubic feet per second of the first water right on the Kalapuya River for fish passage and fish restoration purposes. In working with ODF&W at the time, of course, what they always stressed to me was that the Kalapuya River was a priority situation for that agency. And that's due to, first of all, the fact that there is this important native steelhead run in the Willamette Basin on the Kalapuya. And secondly, that the Kalapuya River provides the best potential for restoration of the spring Chinook run as well. As I said, this 15 cubic feet per second is the first right on the Kalapuya River with a priority date of 1858. So that obviously provides the ultimate in protection and was something that was very important. The ability to quote, call the river is the term that's used in water law to protect this 15 CFS. It will result in low flow protection for the fishery resource
But it also is a level that the local irrigators felt that they could live with and still be able to carry on their operations without significant impact. The Parks and Recreation Department in April of 1994 approved their staff's feasibility study for acquisition of the mills and said, I quote from a staff report, "The basic finding is that the site is an extremely significant and intact historical resource and a good location for interpretation of a number of historic themes, primarily an agricultural theme in the central Willamette Valley." And they also, in their own, this being Parks and Rec's acquisition site evaluation, noted that this opportunity, and I quote, "this opportunity has been determined to be a high value for the OPRD system. Given adequate funding, it is recommended that OPRD acquire the property." Their commission voted unanimously to accept those the feasibility report and proceed with an appraisal. This was back in 1994. The second thing I'd like to do briefly is talk about a couple of the amendments as a way of clarification. They were touched on briefly by the committee administrator, and I think she did a good job of that. But just real quickly, that first amendment that's brought up talks about deleting sections or lines 6 through 12 and then inserting some language. And the purpose of the deletion is basically to take out, and this is in section 4 of the bill itself, the purpose of that deletion is to take out specific language that was limiting specific ways the water rights could be utilized. We felt it was better to essentially simplify the language and leave it up to the State Parks Department instead of trying to limit the purposes in the bill itself. The insertion, which is the language about retaining permanently the ownership of the water rights, is really to make it clear that the water rights should remain appurtenant to the Thompson's Mill site, and that the Parks and Recreation Department should permanently retain ownership of those related water rights. And this was to eliminate concern that the water rights would be split off from the property and sold off. And secondly, it obviously protects the mill's operation and water rights for the future. The second amendment that's listed in the proposed amendments is the amendment in line 14, where it deletes identified critical and inserts important as far as fish passage is concerned. And really that was done for the purpose of benefiting fish passage. There was some concern that the original language of saying identified critical fish passage times was too restrictive, and that therefore, whether it's ODF&W or the Parks and Recreation Department providing for fish passage, they wanted to be able to have the flexibility to obviously provide fish passage during all important fish passage times. So it's actually a looser standard, but it's for the benefit of the fishery resource. The other amendments I won't go into, given the shortness of time, I think we should deal with this. They're basically housekeeping measures that clarify matters and as far as relating to regulation by the water master and those sorts of things. And unless you have any questions on those parts, I don't feel it's necessary to go into that. Just in conclusion of my remarks, there have been some concerns expressed by the governor's office that, you know, you would be earmarking Measure 66 funds for specific projects before these projects are ranked by the various state agencies. And I guess what I'd ask you to do, number one, is realize and ask the state agencies, is the Kalapuya River and the fishery resource there an important priority? And I think you'd get the answer from ODF&W that it definitely was. And also from the Parks and Recreation Department that Thompson's Mills is a unique historic resource that should be maintained. So in essence, even though there hasn't been a ranking of projects, this proposal isn't new. It's been around, and the agencies obviously have dealt with it and realized what a unique opportunity it is. It clearly qualifies for the salmon recovery aspects as well as the park acquisition requirements under Measure 66. And I think it provides a great opportunity, an amazing opportunity for investment in the future of salmon and steelhead, the Parks Department and the people of the state of Oregon to bring in a truly incredible state historic resource for the benefit of the people of our state. Thank you. Questions?
Senator Duke?
Have you looked at the state parks budget as it came out of the subcommittee on ways and means?
I haven't reviewed that budget, no.
There's a lot of backfill in that budget and of the general fund, and I don't recall there being any additional money for purchase of property. What would that do to this if we passed this bill?
To the Parks and Recreation Department budget?
Well, yeah, how would this bill and that and a budget without money for new lands fit together?
I'm afraid I'm at a loss as far as in addressing that issue. I'm not familiar with the state Parks and Recreation budget.
This bill says you shall buy this property.
Right.
And you shall buy it out of Measure 66 monies. And there was a big struggle in subcommittee, but I don't recall any money in there for acquisition.
Yeah, I'm not aware that Parks and Recreation is actually, I don't believe they set forth any acquisition monies in their budget.
Question, I kind of think the question raises a good question. Is there a deadline for purchasing the bill? Okay. What did he say? Yeah. Further questions?
Sure, Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is a question. I'm just concerned that we're not hearing anything from the Parks Department. And their absence is, unless they're somewhere in the audience. Oh, there is.
Thank you.
Yes.
Fair market value. That bothers me a little bit. How are you going about establishing fair market value in this particular case?
I believe that would be done by an appraisal. And some of the part of the bill that addresses that is a requirement that the appraisal be done by an appraisal service that's familiar with the value of water rights. Obviously, the water rights aspect of the property is very important, and much of the value of the property is tied to the water rights being the first right on the Calabuya River, 35 cubic feet per second, as well as other water rights. There's an additional right for 180 CFS.
Who establishes who that person is? Is that, I mean, I can see if the landowner went out and said, this is the person of the state now, it could make a huge difference in the amount of dollars that it could be, the number that's passed. So who establishes that?
Well, Representative Thompson, it's not specified in the bill. I would presume that the Parks Recreation Department would be the one who would choose the appraisal firm to conduct the appraisal.
Representative King.
You're specifying purchase of the water rights, I guess is a better word than property in this case, from the Parks Department. But it seems like one of the reasons why the state would be involved in the first place is salmon recovery, which is not a park's function. That's a salmon recovery function, which is a different fund. I'm wondering why, you're specifying parks.
Representative King, the bill specifies Measure 66 money, and I guess we envisioned that there's a possibility of a cooperative purchase between salmon and parks. Salmon possibly, once the value of the water rights and the value of the property are established, I think both entities, parks and the salmon committees, would look at the various pieces that would fit with their long-range plan.
Thank you. And if I may further add, Representative King, the resource and development of Thompson's Mills as a state park is certainly very important. It's an incredible resource, and anyone that's been down there would tell you it would make an amazing state park. All for the purposes of the mill and operational and demonstrational purposes, you could also use it for agricultural themes to show fish passage and fish restoration work on the ground. And in that sense, I think it does present a unique resource for the Parks Department as well.
Mr.
Chairman, thank you. I think I'll just make a general statement here. We will have the State Parks Department come forward, and I've not visited the site. I look at the who's signed up on here. Obviously, most of you have already made the determination it's a great idea. And I would probably concur with that. My only concern is that, and maybe we've done this historically before, I'm not sure, but I got some parks in my department, in my district I'd like to have sited as well. It's a super siding bill, is what this is. And I know Sumter State Park, started by the locals and turned over to the state. The locals believe the state has not continued to develop that park as they should have. And I just throw that out as a throw in the back of our minds as we go through this process. Sounds like a great idea in many ways, and I'm not trying to throw water on it, but fact of the matter is that's the road we seem to be going down.
Is there any intention to move the park to Umatilla? Actually, we have so many witnesses on this. I think what we need to do is just move forward. I appreciate the comments from Restaurant Lundquist. I think that does need to weigh into our considerations. I don't think there's more than one Thompson's Mill, and maybe not more than one in America like this one, but we'll talk about that when we hear from the Boston Mill Society in a bit. We haven't heard from...
Harry Seeley.
Hi, Mr. Seeley. How are you this morning?
Good. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Harry Seeley. I'm a research associate with Columbia Economics, and I was asked by Thompson Mills to come and testify regarding the valuation of the water rights. To provide a little background briefly, in-stream flow markets developed from a need to protect and improve riparian habitat. It was found that minimum stream flows were ineffective at protecting that habitat due to the relatively junior seniority date. Those were later converted to in-stream rights, but again, they were still ineffective. Changes in Oregon water law in 1987 allowed public or private entities to go ahead and purchase water for in-stream flow rights, and with that, they could then purchase senior water rights and actually protect the flow during critical low-flow periods. Typically, the value of water transferred to in-stream flows has been the agricultural production value of water because they are the largest water-using sector in Oregon. Between 1990 and 1997, public and private groups have spent nearly $62 million to purchase an eighth of 2 million acre-feet of water to augment in-stream flow in the West. During that same period, the average annual lease price was $30 per acre-foot. The average purchase price was $397 per acre foot. To give you an idea of the range of purchase prices, the low was $65 an acre foot, and while the high was $850 an acre foot. Mm. In 1996, the survey in Oregon indicated that the average irrigation right sells for approximately $350 per acre foot, but the range that provided gives you an idea that averages aren't a very good measure of water rights values in most cases. No hydropower rights transferred to in-stream flow were identified in the water rights evaluation process. As a result, we used some analyses that rely upon comparative sales and statistical methods to determine the value of water. One of the more preferred methods, and the one that we used, was the Zonic pricing method, which uses actual market sales information in Linn County. Identified 63 usable market sales in the last few years to put together a statistical model which looked at the value of land with and without water rights. That incremental value then is the value per acre foot. The results of that were that we came up with a value of $13 per acre foot in Linn County. To provide you with some comparisons, in the Pacific Northwest, the purchase price of water has been around between $88 and $150. Now, the $150 is an offer price from the Bureau of Reclamation and represents the value of stored water, basically the cost of stored water in reservoirs. The $88 typically reflects purchases from EPA and Oregon Water Trust.
Mm-hmm. Is it your contention that the value of the water is high?
No, I'm not trying to make that contention at all. I'm actually trying to provide a value for the water right at Thompson Mill.
Okay. I guess what I'd like to do, Mr. Chu, is have you summarize. We've got a lot of folks on the list.
Okay.
A few minutes to get through, and I think folks would like to hear from Mr. Babbitt and the other witness.
Okay.
Okay.
I just thought it would be useful to provide a little background on the value to ground you folks and what people are actually paying. To go ahead and conclude then, we found that the 35 CFS right, based upon our statistical analysis, is worth about $1.6 million.
Senator Duke?
Sorry, I was distracted. Your last figure was that value. I guess I'm wondering, what do we anticipate? What kind of range are we looking at for the total purchase of the property?
Okay. Based upon the $130 an acre foot that we calculated, the purchase price for the 35 CFS right held by Thompson's Mills would be $1.6 million. Based upon the $150 an acre foot that the Bureau of Reclamation currently offers to augment in stream flows, it would be nearly $1.9 million. So that's a relevant range that you're looking at.
That's somewhere between 1.6 and 1.9. That's for water. Does that include the land as well?
No, it's not.
Do we have a feel for what the whole purchase price is likely to be?
I was not asked to conduct an appraisal.
I have a blank on page 2, and I figured we probably had to fill it in at some point.
I think that's probably what the appraisal is all about. But, well, Mr. Brown, let's have an overview of this process. And actually, the question that occurs to me is, what's the motivation for wanting to sell this property? You've got that at the central core of this issue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Dave Babbitt, owner and operator of Thompson's Mills. To briefly encapsulate what brings us to this table, approximately 10 years ago, our perspective was that we had a listing of salmon and steelhead coming in the Willamette Basin. In 1994, we went through through 93 through 95, we went through a long drawn out process to attempt to move the property into state ownership because we felt that listing was coming closer. As part of that process, and during the negotiations with Parks and Recreation Department, we were providing tours of the facility to members of the commission, and a newspaper reporter was invited along unbeknownst to us, prematurely broke the story, and the resulting hysteria among the local populace served to cause a lot of people to back away from the proposed deal. The other thing that happened at the same time was the appraisal process that was conducted by the State Parks and Recreation Department was completed, and as part of that process, there were considerable flaws. We felt that the appraisers really were not qualified to appraise the property, particularly the water rights, and the appraised value at that time came in at $700,000, which is considerably different from the value that Mr. Seeley has just put out of a high end of almost $2 million just for the oldest water right. So there were some glaring errors, we felt, in the appraisal process, and in conjunction with the fact that there was a lot of heartburn from the local populace, the deal just went away. In the interim, since that time, 1995 on to 1997-1998, we eventually did get a coho listing. The Oregon Plan was implemented, and as a part of that implementation of the Oregon Plan, some of the state agency people in a number of agencies felt that that also opened the door for the Willamette Basin to become under greater scrutiny. We have had a running gunfight with ODFW for the last 20 years over water management. And while we have tended to prevail because our water rights are very old and are still in full force,
It takes a considerable amount of effort to continue to deal with these repeated incursions. With the listing that has occurred in the Willamette Basin now, this year, we expect that heightened scrutiny, further heightened scrutiny, to compound and complicate the issues. So we currently have a draft proposal that has been provided to us by ODFW that essentially reallocates approximately one-third of our entire water right for fish passage. And one-third of the water rights is roughly about 60 cubic feet per second, which is greatly in excess of the oldest 1858-35 CFS right. And in the table that is provided in the packet of information on page 19, if you look at that, you will see that the actual spread of value at 65 CFS, which is essentially what we think the ODFW people would need to do all the things that they want to do, the spread on that level of water usage for the 180-day irrigation period ranges from roughly $2 million to $3.5 million in round numbers for that one-third of the water right. So we think there's a lot of value there. State Parks and Recreation has not conducted a reappraisal of the property, so we're a little hesitant to throw numbers out, but we think we can safely say that we can pretty well justify somewhere between $4 and $6 million for the value of the property, and with the caveat that a great deal of the value is the water, and therefore we feel should come out of the Measure 66 salmon side of the funds, not the park side. Just to kind of wind down here, because I know there are other people that want to testify, I would reiterate that this looks like a parks bill on the surface, but this is really being driven by the salmon, the listings for the Upper Willamette Basin. We think that we qualify under both sides of Measure 66, both the salmon and parks side. We leave to the committee to delineate how funds should be taken care of, and Mr. Chair has raised a point that there is no time limit on when this would have to be done, but we think it does need to be done to defuse any potential further conflicts, and we're willing to work to make that happen.
Representative King, and then Representative Lundquist.
Holmes, the river bottom.
Mr. Chair, President of King, according to our surveys, some of the channels that we utilize to provide flows to the mill, we own both banks and the bottom of the river. In other areas of the channel, we have easements that allow us to levy water through the system, and in those cases, I believe the property owners, the registered property owners, own both the banks and the bottom of those channels. And then lastly, portions of the property, the survey boundaries are to the center of the river.
And let me correct in assuming then that this is not a navigable river, you know, at this point.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, in 1983, I believe, when I first became embroiled in navigability issues, part of the Kalapuya was eventually declared navigable. That part was the lowest 3 miles of the river, I believe, where it runs into the Willamette. And then I believe a stretch above Crawfordsville, which I'm not sure the river mile of the location of that, but it's considerably above us. We're located at River Mile 19, and I would point out that we have had a number of dams on the river since 1858, which preclude navigation at the time of statehood.
And I agree that the water rights have a lot of value, and that, you know, any purchasing you'd be paid fair price for that, but I would also maintain that for salmon issues, I think the bottom of the river also has, you know, substantial value as well.
Thank you. Do you, the water ride, just so I understand, is used exclusively for the mill operation, is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lundquist, we have a number of water rights currently in force. We have one in 1858, one in 1933, both of which are used as power claims to drive the mill machinery. We have a 1985 water right, which allows us to generate and sell electricity. And then we have a number of 1939 water rights that allow us to irrigate all of our farmland.
And how much, maybe a 7 year on this, how much farmland are you irrigating?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lundquist, I believe we have irrigation rights for approximately 50 acres in pound numbers.
55, right around 55 acres.
So X percent in round figures is used for the mill. What's that?
180 CFS is or the mill's water rights in total. There's 35 CFS for the 1858 water rights and another 145 CFS of the 1933 water rights.
Okay, so the majority is used for mill operation, is that a true statement?
Yes, far and away.
And follow-up question to, well, let me ask one other question first of the owner. If you were to buy water rights to operate a mill, or is there any way of determining what the value of that is based on those kind of consumptions rather than irrigation rights?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lundquist, the only way you could buy water rights to power a mill today would be you would have to buy those water rights from another landowner. And you would essentially be buying irrigation rights and converting them from a consumptive use into a non-consumptive use. And you would have to pay a premium over the value of the irrigation right. And Mr. Seeley has determined that the value for the purposes of doing that conversion would be, for a permanent purchase, $130 per acre foot for a permanent purchase and $13 per acre foot to lease that water.
I might add, we're talking about 180 cubic feet per segment, and basically, I think it's safe to say it would be impossible to be allowed to purchase something like this on the open market. It's very unusual.
I guess what I'm getting a little bit is, could you financially, if you could find those water rights, could you financially make it a positive endeavor to buy those kind of water rights to run a mill? In other words, is there an economic correlation there, or are they beyond that?
Mr. Chair, to give an idea, Representative Lundquist, let me put this in perspective. 180 cubic feet per second annualized and converted into acre feet is about 80,000 acre feet a year. That's enough water to irrigate 35,000 acres every year of farmland. That's how much water we're talking about here.
I understand that.
And in addition, and to get to your question, I think that if you had to buy that water to power a mill today, it would not be economically justifiable unless you had an extreme amount of fall or head so that you could generate a lot of power to recover your startup costs.
And one last question on Mr. Moon's, and I think I know the answer, but you're the authority. Well, these water rights could be sold for agricultural purposes?
That would be basically impossible, because we're talking about non-consumptive rights, and to convert them over to a consumptive right, you would obviously get objections that you'd be changing the nature of the water right and increasing the usage of them. So the short answer is no, you couldn't convert the other way. You could convert an irrigation right to a power right, conceivably, but not going back the other direction.
Further questions for the panel? If not, I'd like to call the folks from the Boston Mill Society, Mr. Martin Thompson, Mr. George Q, and then we'd like to follow, oh, I beg your pardon, Jason Atkinson. Representative Atkinson, you are next up. Thank you.
I'll be brief for the record. Jason Atkinson, State Representative, District 51, and chief co-sponsor of this bill. For the record, unlike Representative Krupp, I guess I should begin by saying I can neither confirm nor deny if they're skipping school to go fishing. I will not make any comments regarding future committee hearings.
Noted for the record.
I want to keep my comments brief, but this is fairly hard for me. When I woke up this morning, I was trying to consider how I would begin a brief testimony on this bill. And I must tell you, I must slow down my comments because it's very easy for me to go down the track of raw deal and to quickly get on a soapbox that concerns the National Marine Fisheries Service. I find it fascinating that we have a situation in which federal government or a state government can shut down, in this particular instance, the federal government can threaten to shut down a business. However, business owners or private property owners do not have the power to sue the king, even though the adjudicated water rights with this particular property are older than the state of Oregon. Going down that road is ridiculously difficult. I do not want to go there, however. I first want to tell you how I got involved with this mill briefly and just make a few comments. I think that, as you probably know, that this bill has taken about 2 months to get this far. And when I first met Dave, we first began to talk about history and water rights and National Fisheries Service and parks and all these fish type of issues. And I became enthralled but curious. And so the first thing I did is, I think about 4 or 5 days after our first meeting, I jumped in my truck and drove down to this thing. I had to see it for myself, first of all. So on a Saturday, I drove down there. And I would really encourage, if there's anybody here that is interested or potentially has any question marks about this site, I would implore you to drive an hour south to visit this. The wood beams are enough to make you attracted to this project. The wood beams in here are milled before Oregon was a state. Turbine power. There's a certain amount of pride if you ever do visit to watch Dave turn on one turbine, and you'll understand, I think, first of all, the romance that's associated with this piece of property. There's all these levers, there's old concrete silos, and I think the thing that is most striking is that this thing smells like it's 150 years old, too. It kind of gets under your skin. Again, just the history of knowing that if Abraham Lincoln would have taken the job as territorial governor of the territory of Oregon, he probably would have got his mill from here. I think that is, to me, just fascinating. When we start talking about mill histories and whatnot, of which I'm interested in, I asked Dave about a mill that I thought was very unique in my in Southern Oregon. It's called the Butte Creek Mill, which is still under operation, and I was fairly proud of the fact that this mill had been under operation since the 1860s, and to which Dave recited calling my particular mill of interest a Johnny Come Lately, as it has been so much older. And so I think just to a few of the comments that have been made before the committee, there really is no other mill like this. And in my research, not only in Oregon, but I think in the Pacific Northwest and west of the Mississippi, this is a fascinating piece of Oregon history. Absolutely fascinating. I think the history of the building, the water rights, all of that, are what the Measure 66 and what the citizens asked us to do with those dollars. I'm so excited about this bill because I see for the first time that this is one opportunity where we can actually fit something together that the citizens said, all right, this is what we want you to do with salmon, this is what we want you to do with parks, and here's an opportunity for us to do this. And I appreciate the fact that we're under limited budgets, and I also appreciate the fact that under the timelines you're given within this bill. But this is what the money was set aside to do, and I see a absolutely perfect fit. And if there's any question with any of you, I implore you to go drive an hour south and watch Dave turn this thing on. It will amaze you. But I think that more than I've had this experience, I think that this is something worth protecting for Oregon citizens. I really believe that. I really believe that kids, students, occasional legislators should visit this thing. This is an amazing part of Oregon history, and for that reason, I wholeheartedly support it. I would urge you to put this on our priority list with the parks. I think that's another thing that this bill does. By pushing this bill forward, we say that this is a priority. I would be happy to answer questions on. I think there's always a little bit of shock when we start talking about prices and we start talking about water rights and whatnot. I'd be more than happy to answer any of those questions. But with that, I implore you to make this a state priority.
Question, Representative Thompson.
Representative Atkinson, you visited the site, and I've dealt with the site off and on, and there's no question it's a very valuable site, but I have a couple of sites on the Oregon coast that I would say are equally as valuable to the citizens of the state of Oregon, and without some kind of a list or priority, isn't it kind of a little bit unfair to say that this site takes a higher priority over those beach sites in the state?
Well, I don't. I think that my comment is to add this to the list, since we haven't created the list. And I think I draw. I don't know if this is an issue of fairness. I would certainly love to come over and talk history on the coast. I'm sure there's other sites. I think the thing that interests me in this, from a history standpoint, is that we have Willamette Valley settlements, we have transportation, we have commerce, we have milling, water rights. To me, there's so much more of this site from a history standpoint that are all put together on one side. I'm sure that there's other sites. There's sites all over the state. But this one, just from my experience, and my experience alone, is very unique.
Follow up?
And I appreciate that, and I appreciate the offer to come to the Oregon coast, but I'm afraid that you and if I got together, we'd spend more of our time fishing and playing hooky than sitting.
If that's an offer, consider it accepted.
And I agree that, for standard purposes, that which I think is the primary reason why they're looking at, going down this road, that they need to be paid fairly, if the state gets involved and ends up with, quote, control of the water. But we are not the substantive committee to deal with parks issues. This committee is only the substantive committee for dealing with salmon issues. And I can see that, if there is a transaction, you end up with two agencies that would need to be, quote, buying off on this process. One, being someone who has authority to deal with, salmon type issues. And then the other, obviously, that in my mind, quote, if parks is involved. I've shared with the property owners here that whereas that may be an outstanding park project, in terms of shall in the bill as versus may in the bill, I feel a lot more comfortable if it's parks may, go on and do, all the park things, but I have some concerns about, obligating the state, to do all of the park type functions as a part of the transaction. And I think our first priority is to do the right thing by the salmon, in terms of, why we need to go down that road and why they need to be treated fairly.
Three comments. First of all, I think that this particular site does the right thing by salmon, given the nature of the property, especially concerning the way that the water is managed. If you look at the green testimony and just start to take a look at how some of the diversionary, the culvert system, the water system, I think that this, first of all, is wrapped in the salmon issue. Secondly, you're absolutely right with regards to parks. And I think that there is, at least, again, speaking for myself, enough interest to follow this through on other substantive committees dealing with parks. You're right, though, in the sense that this uniqueness, I'd measure 66 brings these two salmon and parks together, and that's the reason why it's here, because it fits what measure 66 intended to do rather than purely a parks bill. So I think that, you know, that's the reason this year I would be committed to following it all the way through. That reason, yeah. Yes.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate it. Let's call forward the folks from the Boston Mill Society, George Steele and Martin Thompson, followed by Jim Lockwood and Joe Rolato.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is George Q. For the record, I live and farm in Shedd, Oregon, which is the home of the Thompson Mill, Boston Mill area. I'm here today representing the board of the Boston Mill Society. With me is Martin Thompson, who is the president of the Boston Mill Society. You are receiving the information you brought along for sake of time. You'll note there's some bulleted material on the front that point out what we think are the main points for the preservation of this, for the movement forward of this bill, and to preserve the Boston Mill and to secure the water rights for the protection and enhancement of the fish population in the Calapooya River. Far the back is some information about the Boston Mill Society, which is a preservation society that was formed about 6 years ago to work towards preserving the historic mill at known as Thompson's Mill locally, and to move it towards a living history museum that would enhance the visibility and of agriculture in the state and in the Willamette Valley. Also, further back, there is some more information as the center about the mill itself and give you some more historical data. The representatives that spoke before us, I think, gave good testimony as to historic value. I think, too, when you referred to this as a win-win situation, it tells about, they told about how this mill not only would preserve a classic historic landmark in the Willamette Valley, but it also enhanced the fish passage on the Calapooya River and address water quality. Further, we support this bill because it also retains water use for the agriculture in the area. We would hope that you could, one of our biggest problems though is timeliness. You will note in our information that the facility is deteriorating. As a Boston Mill Society, we have not been able to secure large funds to renovate it because the ownership of the facility has been in question, not in question who owned it, but just whether the renovations should go forward. The timeliness then is a question that needs to be addressed. I guess Mr. Thompson, do you have anything to add?
So I'd like to say one or two things. It was my grandfather who in 1891 purchased Thompson's Mills, and it's been in operation, you know, since 1858, so it was a fairly old mill when he purchased it. He immediately set about converting it to roller milling. When he passed on, my uncle continued the operation. When he passed on, his son, my cousin, continued the operation up until 1974. While I haven't had a personal involvement in the operation of the mill, I've certainly had a continuing and deep interest in seeing the mill used for a living history, a museum, and agricultural interpretive center. The location is ideal for that type of application. And the Boston Mill Society, as a nonprofit 501c3, is in a good position to help raise funds from foundations, individuals, corporations, and so on to help fund an operation. So, and I think that the location in the heart of the Willamette Valley, in the center of the ryegrass industry, and the destination of so many people coming over the Oregon Trail really does make this a very unique spot. And as an agricultural interpretive center, it's within
an easy round-trip ride from the populated areas of the state, Portland metro area. So it makes it an ideal opportunity for the state to capitalize on this resource and do something good right now. Thank you.
Question, Mr. Thompson, is there any national recognition for the preservation of this mill?
Yeah, the mill is listed on the National Register for Historic Places, both the mill and the mill owner's house, which was built by my grandfather in 1904. The site has also been nominated as one of the 11 most endangered sites in America, and a group of people from the National Trust, three people, visited the site less than three or 4 weeks ago. So there is considerable recognition.
Could I get a clarification? One of the 11 most endangered historic sites in America?
Yeah.
Nationally?
Yeah, nationally. And we nominated that. Anyone can nominate a site, and it's in process.
Further questions? Hearing none, we'll go ahead and call Mr. Terry Lammers and Mr. Gary Springer for brief testimony. Followed by Jim Lockwood from Oregon Parks and Recreation and Joe Rollator from ODF&W. Gentlemen, good morning.
Morning.
Briefly summarize your testimony, please.
Okay. For the record, my name is Gary Springer. I live in Corvallis. I'm a logger and a small woodland owner. I help manage a family-owned tree farm 30 miles west of Corvallis in the headwaters of the Clinton River watershed. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 1287. I'm very familiar with the Thompson's Mill. I've visited it a number of times, and I know the owners, Dave and Marlene Babbitts, very well. If you haven't been to the Thompson's Mill, I would urge you to ask the Babbitts for a tour. This mill is truly a unique and living piece of Oregon history. It is one of the oldest and still operating water-powered mills in the western United States, as you've heard this morning. Thompson's Mill sits on the banks of the lower Calapooya, and while the Calapooya is not as well known as other Cascade tributaries to the Willamette River, it does provide a lot of upstream habitat for steelhead trout and Chinook salmon, in addition to their 140-year-old mill, the Babbitts own the oldest water rights in the Calapooya drainage. Senate Bill 1287 represents an offer by the Babbitts to sell to the state of Oregon both the mill site and the associated water rights at fair market value. I think the state should take them up on that offer. This bill would allow the state to preserve the Thompson's Mill as a one-of-a-kind historic landmark. It would make a great addition to our state park system. This bill would also give the state the ability to control water flow at the mill's dams for the benefit of fish migration with the purchase of the water rights. Enhancing our state park system and purchasing in-stream water rights from willing sellers are certainly in keeping with goals of both Measure 66 and the Oregon Plan. The water rights purchased in Senate Bill 1287 seems especially appropriate and timely given the recent fish listings in the Willamette River watershed. I know the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and NIMS are concerned that due to the operation of Thompson's Mill, there may not always be enough water in the fish ladders there for unrestricted passage of adult and juvenile steelhead and salmon. The temptation must be great with some in those agencies to use the recent ESA listings as a lever and simply force the Babbitts to put more Calapooya water through the ladders. This might be a fish-friendly action, but it would ignore the Babbitts' water rights, of course, and take their livelihood away from them for at least half of each year. Senate Bill 1287 is a much better option because it is both fish-friendly and human-friendly. As forest landowners, my family is paying for increased habitat along several miles of salmon streams that flow through our tree farm. As a resident of Corvallis, I am about to start paying more to correct the negative impact my city has on the Willamette River. However, as members of the public at large, you and I haven't really had to step up to the plate in a similar way for salmon recovery. Senate Bill 1287 gives us an important opportunity to do that. I hope you will join me in support of this bill. Thanks.
Join.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Co-Chair Messerly, members of the committee, my name is Terry Lammers. I'm the State Issues Coordinator with the Small Woodlands Association. We've come out in support of this bill because we believe in property rights. The state and various federal agencies at times have had a heavy hand, and we think that this bill will allow them to put their money where their mouth is. Many people today have talked about the uniqueness of the site, and that cannot be overstated. I've been through the mill, and my great-great-great-grandfather perhaps would have felt right at home in a facility such as that. It's got machinery in there that I can't even figure out how it works. And it's extremely unique and unlikely to be duplicated at any point in the future at any cost. One thing that hasn't been pointed out today is the interest in the mill site by Hollywood. It has been used in at least one movie that I'm aware of, though I do forget the name of the movie. I think it should be preserved. The water rights, the salmon recovery issue, the uniqueness of the mill, they all combine to present a great opportunity for the people of Oregon. Thank you.
Any questions for the panel? Seeing none, I'd like to hear from the folks from Parks and Rec and from ODF&W, please. Called Joe Rollator and Jim Lockwood.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Lockwood from the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and thanks for the opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 1287. I could hardly say anything more positive than has already been said. This is a wonderful location. There's no doubt about that. A number of the members of the committee, both some that are here as well as some that are not here at the moment, also have ideas of their own that they suggest the Parks and Recreation Department purchase or develop. And so from our perspective, while this is a good site, there are many others that are under consideration. And as some of you may recall, on March 25th, the governor sent a letter to the Legislative Assembly to the leadership suggesting that the bills to purchase specific properties, that possibly the best approach to that would be to refer the group of properties or the group of development ideas to the Oregon Parks and Recreation Commission. We support that from the standpoint that if the Parks and Recreation Commission could then weigh and balance the relative merits, weigh out the amount of funding available at the time and so on, that's what they're charged with doing, and we would suggest that you pass those along to them. As you may or may not be aware, the relating clause on this bill is broad enough that you can use it for that purpose or some other one. But I don't want any of my comments to take away from the mill, its operation, its value, anything like that at all. This is one of many good ideas that this body has been discussing with us. And in one place or another, and we're suggesting the Parks Commission, but one place or another, the relative merits need to be weighed, and we're happy to work with whatever process you select. Thank you very much.
Question? Mr. Rowe?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I'm the assistant to the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I can't add very much to the previous testimony except to say that there are high fish values at this site for steelhead, winter steelhead, spring salmon, spring chinook, and cutthroat trout. We believe that purchase of the Thompson's Mill site could greatly enhance the fisheries resource at this site. However, we are very concerned that adequate fish flows be the top priority in the purchase of this site. Our interest is in providing flows. I had not seen the Dash 1 amendments, nor had my staff, until I came here today. I do not know about the relative effect of whether that meets our needs for adequate fish flow. But I will say this is an important site on our list of priorities for restoration of salmon to the Willamette Valley. But our top priority, if we acquire this site on behalf of our agency, will be to ensure that there is adequate flow for passage, both upstream and downstream, for the species that are native to this California area. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'd like to call Peter Jensen, please.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Peter Jensen, and I reside at Highway 228-33679, Halsey in Linn County. I've been a dairy farmer in that location for 30 years, and I no longer have a dairy herd, but I raise dairy replacement heifers, and as a fact, we border the Talapuya River for quite a while, and water from it, obviously. Today I'm testifying on behalf of the Talapuya Irrigation District, of which I serve as president. The district was created 50 years ago by this body. A special law was passed to allow the district. It's an irrigation district, however, it does not do anything with the water. It's a taxing district, and the purpose is to reimburse the owners of the Thompson Mills for the loss of water for the milling operation and in place by electricity. And there's about 2,300 acres in the district, and there's a lot of different users. At this time, there's a great concern out in the community and among the people who water what is going to happen to their water rights. They all have water rights, but they are all basically later rights than the original Thompson Mills rights. And looking at the changes that might come down the line, there's a lot of concern whether we'll still be able to have water to water with. So the irrigation district would welcome ownership by the Parks Department, provided an arrangement is made, as I understand it is, at least the way it's stated in the bill, is along the memorandum understanding that we received back in 1994 when the same thing was contemplated. And I guess I want to say that I'm also a member of the Linn County Farm Bureau, and the board voted in the April meeting to support Senate Bill 1287, provided that the needs of the irrigators were met and that the surrounding farmers were seriously taken into consideration. And when this, I could just add this, I haven't written this down, but when this proposal first surfaced, originally was quite a lot of opposition in the among the ryegrass seed growers that bordered the mill, and they were concerned about what would happen. So I think that there should be some provisions in there when the increased traffic would not interfere with harvest time and busy time on the farms, and that was, I think, their main concern that there would be. If I may address something that I really am not qualified for, but it was ownership of the bottom of the California River. My original deeds called for ownership to the center of the channel. When a piece of property changed hands here a little while ago, a few years ago, the previous owner had ownership to the center of the channel. But when I got the deed, it only went to the ordinary high water mark, and I realized it's tied into the navigation issue and the whole thing, but I think that thing is still not solved. Basically what I have to say on this issue.
Any questions? Richard Lundquist.
Very quickly, thank you. Good to see you again, Pete.
See, I'm not the only cow milker in here.
Yeah. And I want the community to understand that the intelligence level of our witness as well, he's now raising replacement. Someone else does the milking, and he just raised replacement. So, and I've been on both sides of issues, so you made a good decision. But regardless of what happens to the mill, how would that affect your water rights, whether it's sold or not sold? I'm a little confused about that.
You know, other people here can address that a lot better, but I guess the concern is, and I'll just say this, that these water rights from the mill are very large for that stream. And if whoever owns those water rights would choose their option of calling that, and I guess the fear among us, just saying it as a person, is that this water will be purchased by some other organization that would be less friendly to us than the state's organization. So I think it's more kind of that everybody around there, I think we would rather deal with the State Parks Department than maybe some other agency or issue that could buy these water rights and use their option and essentially turn everybody off. And what we've been doing is for paying them for using the water. So in a sense, we have been using that water on the ground.
Question, Kirsten?
I'm addressing the question a little bit. I think that if the state buys the water, you're probably going to be dealing with the Fish and Wildlife Department as versus the Parks Department regarding the water. I mean, if the parks are involved, they'll probably be involved in managing the grounds and maybe the mill and in demonstration work. But probably in terms of water activity, you'd be dealing with ODF&W.
Yeah. As I understand in the bill, it calls for a certain minimum flow that they will not call the river, as the saying goes, if there is that much water in it.
We'd like to call Lucy Skillstad and Mr. Lex from the Albany Convention Visitors Bureau and Pete Kett from Oregon Farm Bureau.
Okay. I'll start. I'm Lucy Skillstad. I'm a resident of Corvallis and the former director of the Horner Museum at Oregon State University for almost 20 years. And I've been a consultant to the Santa Fe Historical Museum, which is a living history museum. And I strongly advocate the acquisition of the site. I'll let you read what I had prepared and I'll just add a few notes to it. I guess I really admire your perseverance in staying with this, so I'll try and be brief. My expertise is in cultural resources. I know that most of you are used to talking natural resources. I hope that you will be able to translate to a cultural resource mentality, which is virtually the same. Essentially, the cultural resources are non-renewable resources, and we, as they come up and as we have the opportunity to save them and do something positive with them for the future, I hope we can do that. I also see the win-win situation. I think that it is it's amazing. It's so unusual to have the opportunity both to save the cultural resource as well as to develop it for future, hopefully for future economic development and tourism, although that may take some time, and also to do good things for the family. It's an unusual situation. This site is one of the most significant sites in the valley. It has great historical depth. The first millstones were brought around the Horn from France. And in fact, I think I've been involved with the site for about 20 years when I first found it and began to, Dave Babbitt kindly allowed me to bring some Horner Museum tour groups to visit the site. And it truly is just awesome. I could hear that. I hear that sense of what you want people to get when they see an historic site from Representative Atkinson's impressions of it. I think one of the other things that should be mentioned is that this is not only a state historic site, I believe it's a regional historic site. This mill helped to feed the gold rush in California. When I lived in California, I always kind of wondered where all those miners got their food. Now I know. It came on mule trains from the Boston Mill. So we have a regionally significant site as well, that it was part of the greater Western movement. I think the potential for development is really fabulous. The location near I-5 is excellent in that regard. Oregon doesn't have a Connors Prairie or Sturbridge Village or Colonial Williamsburg. We could have it in this mill. Take a while, but it can happen. And I think I heard the remark made that the parks have struggled to adequately fund and develop the sites that they do have. And I think in this case, there's an added component. I cheered when the Boston Mill Society came into existence, but I soon realized that it's not easy to raise money and to begin development if the site that you're dealing with is in private ownership. So I think that the potential to cooperate and partner with the society could greatly enhance the park's ability to deal appropriately with the site and make it into a really wonderful educational interpretive center. Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Chair. My name is Jimmy Luke. I'm the executive director for the Albany Tourism and Convention Association, and I'm speaking in support of SB 1287, the Pulitzer Prize. I want to thank you all for taking the time to hear us this morning and persevere through all of this testimony. We've listened to a lot of interesting technical information about CFM, salmon, and water rights and all those other things that I know absolutely nothing of. So I ask you to switch gears for just a moment and allow me to talk about tourism, which I'm a little more qualified to talk about. Tourism in Oregon is a very thriving business. We have $5.2 billion brought in by tourists last year. About a third of that money comes from historical or heritage tourism, and heritage tourism is when someone travels to a particular area to see what past history was or what a culture was like. In Albany, we have three different historic districts. We are very proud of the fact that we have the largest variety of historic architectural structures. Each year, there are thousands of people that come through Albany to tour these different districts, and they walk through the communities looking at the buildings, or they ride on horse-drawn wagons, or they buy tickets and go on interior tours of some of the homes that people live in there. We're also very fortunate to be surrounded by those wonderful covered bridges that are so well preserved here in our area. About 4 weeks ago, there is a writer in Seattle. Her name is Hilda Anderson. She wrote articles about an article about the covered bridges in the Lynn and Lane County areas, and that was in the Seattle Times and the Seattle PI. That one article brought to my office 500 calls in the next few days. It demonstrates the kind of interest that there is in this historic architecture here in this area. I burden you with these facts and figures this morning because I want to impress on you how important and how vital historical tourism is to Oregon. We have many different styles, as I said, of architecture in Albany. There's the wonderful ornate Queen Anne styles. There's the very charming farmhouses, but nowhere do we have anything that's at all like the Boston Flour Mill. Or Thompson's Flour Mill is the different name for it. The mill is a perfect fit to this historic scheme and the heritage tourism idea of the Mid-Valley. Heritage tourists tend to be very low impact for communities and environments. They come to absorb and to observe, not to disturb what's there. So I urge you to support House Bill 1287, not just because it's a beautiful site, not just because it's a historic site, but because we need to preserve it for future generations so that they can see what Oregon was like and what our heritage was like. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Kess, do you have anything other than you're in support of the bill to say?
Yeah, because
can you make
for the record
30 seconds?
Yes, for the record, Pete Kess, Associate Director of Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We're obviously in favor of this bill, but I thought that to sum it up, it's not just win-win. There's six wins here. There's a win for the fishery resource. There's a win for the cultural resource.
There's a win for the agricultural resource through this bill is protected. There's a win for education because it keeps the history of our state. It will make people aware of agriculture and otherwise. There's a win for the economy, which is necessary in the area, and there's a win for the landowner. We can't help but be for this bill like our local Farm Bureau is. Thank you.
Questions for the panel?
I have a question.
Senator?
Is this EFU land?
Yes, it's outside. It's outside the urban growth boundary, yes.
I just lose track with the Farm Bureau on EFU land periodically as to what's okay and what isn't okay.
In this particular situation, I think it will have a tendency to protect the EFU land around it because we're putting it back in shape. We're not adding anything new.
Any further questions for the panel? Thank you. Colleagues, I'm going to go into a work session on this bill, and then we need to go into a work session on about three other bills that we need to make sure we have a tap hearing to keep alive. About four other bills. Okay, we're in work session on Senate Bill 1287. Colleagues, what's your pleasure on the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Question, Rosensky?
I do have a question for Mr. Rollator, if I may.
Mr. Rollator is here. Mr. Rollator, would you come up, please?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Joe Rollator, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Thank you. My understanding, there are several dams on the Calafuya, and I haven't visited the site. My understanding is that they're pretty fish-friendly, but I don't know what the impression of ODFMW is there, and I don't know about what, since you've testified that the primary purpose of ODFMW would be, fish habitat, fish preservation issues, then what would be, the potential future of those dams, and, would there be impact upon the ability to operate those dams and the mill as a mill operating mill, historical museum type of facility.
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, as I said before, I really hadn't seen the -1 amendments until today, so my staff has not had time to adequately review those. And as Mr. Babbitt, I think, referred to while I was out of the room, we've had a difficult situation, overfish passage at this site, partially because of his unique date of water rights and the fact that he predates statehood. My staff has not had a chance to adequately look at the amendments and make sure that fish passage is a top priority as in this bill as amended. I understand that there is fish passage at each of the dams that are there now, but I am unable to tell you what adequate flow at those particular dams might be.
And so it's all up then, you don't feel comfortable you could testify that the fish passage issues are clearly adequate for endangered species means you're probably also not able to state any idea in terms of the future use or potential non-use or distance of those dams in the future then.
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, I think that's a correct characterization. I'm just unable at this time to tell you what those requirements for fish passage might be. And I think that would be a very difficult issue for anybody to say one way or the other, whether it is adequate or is not adequate. Now, I think you might consider an amendment that gives a priority to the water at the site for fish passage in some way, but I don't know how. I'm sorry, I just haven't had a chance to look at that and figure out how to write it up.
Well, if I may follow it, it appears that there could be the possibility that the Parks Department might have one authority instead of goals. You might have another, authority instead of goals. I'm not sure that there's a way where, you know, one department, you know, can have its purpose supersede, you know, that of another if there is this agreement.
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, I believe that is a problem, an inherent problem that needs to be addressed in some way. Who needs to be determined whose priorities have priority, running the mill or running fish passage. It's hard for me to believe that there wouldn't be a way that we could do both. But I can't tell you exactly how that would work. But as a concept, I'm sure that we could come up with a way that would work adequately.
Point of clarification.
Judith, this bill goes through the same procedure. The preceding bill goes to the House and then comes back to the committee before it goes to the...
Mr. Chair, Representative Preston, no, this has a prior reference to Ways and Means, so it would go from this committee to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
And then how does it function from there?
And then when it comes out of Joint Ways and Means being a Senate bill, it would go then first to the Senate floor and then pass on to the House floor.
So it won't come back before the committee?
Correct.
Representative King.
I have another procedure question, and since we're the substantive committee for SAMU's and not for parks, I'm wondering why it wouldn't go to parks. Is it going to go through parks subcommittee before it goes to full Ways and Means, or it just goes to full Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, that's right. Once full Ways and Means has it in their possession, they will assign it to a subcommittee. The co-chair will assign it.
If the committee has deliberated fully, it's probably time to move the bill and get our cast out.
Mr. Chair, can I make a statement?
Representative Thompson.
I think this is a very worthwhile project, and sometimes there's votes cast for red flags to alert other people that there's problems, and I think that these problems can be worked out. So I will vote no on this as a red flag, not as being against the project, but there are some problems to be worked out with people above.
Representative Thompson, if the committee made a recommendation to Ways and Means to a subsequent referral for parks, would that affect your ability to support the bill?
I still think that there's problems in other bodies, and if my name shows up as a no, it'll alert them. It doesn't mean not to. That this shouldn't move forward in the process. So.
Senator Duke.
And I'm sort of the flip side of that. I'm going to vote for it today because I think it needs to move on to help the discussions that are going on with the property owners and with parks. But I share Representative Lundquist's concerns about supersiding. Because there's new money out there, it doesn't mean that we ought to be setting the priority list for spending it. I figure there's one bill this session, there'll be three next session, and then we will be deciding for state parks what all of their state parks are. And on that, I should remind you that if one of the speakers didn't while I was in my other committee, that Washington County has no state parks. I represent a part of Washington County. And so that there are other areas of the state that would like to be rivaling up to the draw. So, but I think that this particular discussion needs to go on. It sounds like we have a real valuable opportunity.
Representative King?
A statement. If this bill was a shell by the water rights and pay a fair price for that, I would be supporting it, as long as there was a may along with the aspect with respect to the Parks Department and some clarification that the salmon water rights issue were the right goal, but seeing as we don't have an amendment in place on that, I'm going to be a no on the bill for that. I would like us to go find some way to buy that and in a timely manner, and I would like to see amendments in that place so we don't lose the momentum that's been generated on having a transaction on behalf of these people.
Further questions or comments?
I will. I'll support the bill coming out of committee. I'm not sure how I'll vote on the floor. on that because there's some answers that I think we need out of this. I think we need to have, it's an unusual situation to be passing the super siding for our parks. And the water associated with it, how much comes out of each agency, do we have the resources? And it says here that they will buy. I realize there's no timeline, but it says this is going to happen. And we pass this bill through the process, so I reserve that right.
Okay, the chair will entertain a motion on Senate Bill 1287 with a recommendation also to, in a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Senator Tarnow makes the motion for, is that a due pass recommendation, Senator Tarnow?
I think so, yes.
Okay. Senator Tarnow makes a motion for a due pass recommendation to the Joint Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. Are there any questions on the motion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Jensen. Aye. Representative King. Nay. Representative Warner. Representative Wunquist. Aye. Representative Thompson. No. Senator Hughes. Aye. Senator Nelson. Aye. Senator Shields. Senator Tarnow. Aye. Representative Lindley. Aye. Aye.
Motion carries for a due pass recommendation. There will be no carriers since it's a subsequent committee.
And I'm going to make a comment. I hope that we wind up buying this park at some point, and I really wish them the best to get this resolved.
I think there's been a lot of excellent discussion this morning on this bill and a lot of good comments that have been raised, and I think the other issue is that some of the concerns that have been raised we do need to deal with. Actually, I have to ask for reconsideration because we forgot to amend in the dash one amendments. So let's I'll accept the motion for reconsideration of the bill. So moved by
We have to have one on the prevailing side.
Senator Dukes moves for reconsideration without objection. So ordered. Reconsideration. We'll accept a motion to amend in the dash one amendments. Is there any objection to the dash one amendments? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll. Oh, I accept the motion for the motion to move Senate Bill 1287 with the due pass recommendation to Joint Ways and Means by prior reference.
As amended.
As amended, motion is made by Senator Tarnow.
So move.
Is there, and the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Nay.
Aye.
Aye. No.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And then we will go out of work session on Senate Bill 1287. We'll go into work session on House Bill 20, public hearing on House Bill 2881. Public hearing is open. Anyone here to testify on 2881? Seeing none, public hearing is closed. I will go into a public work session on Senate Bill 778. Public hearing is open. Seeing no testimony, public hearing is closed. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 862. Public hearing is open. Seeing no testimony, public hearing is closed. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1160. Public hearing is open. Seeing no testimony, public hearing is closed. Committee is adjourned. You didn't do